Epilogue. As everyone might wish, nothing but goodness seems to have attended the last years of William Smith's life. He moved from Hackness to his cottage in Scarborough. He cultivated a small garden. He read and tried in vain to write the story of his own life. He nursed his now fast-fading wife. He went for long walks on the cliffs. He raised geese and sent them off to his relations. He wrote letters aplenty, letters that show him to be a happy old countryman, lost in the revelry of a comfortable old age. A literary critic might have cruel amusement with his style. I have omitted from this account all of his innumerable attempts at writing poetry, the results of which were execrable at best. The paragraph that follows is not chosen for its merit as a piece of writing, but just to show the new-found contentment which had been so sorely missing from his life before. It was an autumn evening as he sat and wrote the following in his journal. When the sunbeam flickered on the gently waved gossamer suspended from the foliage, and filmy winged insects were waving up and down, innumerable as if promiscuously enjoying the ethereal sports of a calm and sunny autumn morn, or that of one of summer's retiring days, I, after breathing from the Bridgewalk terrace the pure air wafted off the ocean's smooth and boundless surface beneath its calm blue canopy, I, so refreshed and on my breakfast feasting, sat and enjoyed the same at my cottage window, fronting that fine and full-grown hawthorn which casts a deep shade across the lawn and those bright distant lights which remind me of Claude's fine forest glades, where flickering gleams of light seem to steal in between the trees. Even so complete is my seclusion and calm retreat from the busy town and its numerous far-distant visitors, who annually come to bathe in the ocean and drink at the Scarborough Spa. Thus calmly to enjoy retirement with the never-failing resources of a well-stored mind is the sweetest pleasure of a full-aged man. He kept his well-stored mind as active as he could. He tried to tinker a little with the geology he knew, but steadily he came to realize that behind the vanguard of the Young Turks who were now running the science, and who had given him his long-due recognition, geology was now accelerating rapidly away from him, the discoveries and theories multiplying at exponential rates. He would travel with near religious punctiliousness to the annual meetings of the newly formed British Association for the Advancement of Science, a body that his nephew John Phillips had played a large part in establishing. But he would understand less and less of what was said, and when he came to suggest or to offer a paper, he found the organizers less than fully engaged by what he had to say. There were respectful pauses, hesitancies in their manner, suggestions about another day, another topic. His papers, wrote the historian Hugh Torrens, in the entry on Smith in the New Dictionary of National Biography, demonstrated all too clearly Smith's great limitations in the new world of non-practical or theoretical geology, to which he was now expected to contribute. Slowly, though Smith probably never came fully to know it, and cruel though it seems to say so, he was becoming out of date. It seems fitting to suggest that, living so close to their playground in Yorkshire's Upper Jurassic, he was becoming a dinosaur himself, in all but name. But the comforts continued to arrive. In the early summer of 1832, Smith travelled down to Oxford, and in a further ceremony received his Wollaston medal, now fresh from the die-makers and engravers. The society had not stinted. The Wollaston had been made by no less a medal-maker than Benjamin Wyon, who held the august post of chief engraver of the seals, and was responsible for designing and manufacturing some of the finest medals in the land, as well as the various great seals with which nation-states, most of them colonial governments, impressed the final versions of their laws. The medal was indeed made of gold. Smith's name was engraved on one side, between a beribboned twine of laurel and palm. Roderick Murchison presented it to him at a ceremony in the Sheldonian Theatre, the graceful 17th-century building that still represents the spiritual core of the great university. He made just a short speech, reminding the assembled gathering that they were in the presence of a great original discoverer in English geology. He suspended the medal on its blue silk ribbon around the old man's neck, and then stepped back to watch with pleased contentment as the assembled worthies of all England's sciences applauded a choice with which everyone seemed to agree. All Oxford and all scientific Britain were now giving William Smith their combined imprimatur. The government, too, chipped in. Within days it was announced that, in consequence of a petition from a panel of scientists, King William IV had agreed to grant Smith a pension for the remainder of his life of £100 a year. It was thought to be only fair that a man whose personal labours for the good of all, as it was put in countless petitions and other laudatory papers, had cost him his fortune, and for a while his freedom, should not be allowed to pass into old age a pauper. £100 was thought a sufficient sum to keep all wolves from the doors. It was gratefully given, and the beneficence gratefully extended to cover the needs of his widow when Smith himself died. He still had one further honour to receive, and that, which was offered, so his nephew reported, quite unexpectedly, during another British Association meeting, was an honorary doctorate of letters. The Association was meeting in Ireland. The Provost and Fellows of Trinity College, Dublin, decided that Mr. Smith must be so elevated. The old man, by now 67, and his increasing deafness depriving him of a full share of enjoyments, was, according to John Phillips, astonished, and sufficiently alive to feelings more common in his youth, to be delighted with the title. The delight was general, though there was astonished dismay in some quarters, too, that the father of English geology had been honoured not by one of England's academic institutions, but by the Premier College in Ireland. He dressed up in his new robes. He doffed his cap at the appropriate moment. He listened to the perorations in Latin. He mingled briefly with his fellow honorees, the three distinguished astronomers, Sir Thomas Brisbane, Professor Gerard Moll, and Francis Bailey, and Louis Agassiz, the Swiss-American naturalist and fossil fish expert, who had come up with the radical notion of the ice site, the Ice Age. Whether, with his Oxfordshire accent, his deafness, his rheumatics, and his general innocence of urban sophistication, Smith felt comfortable in such august company, we can but wonder. John Phillips left a less than candid record of the occasion. In any case, he was soon to be plucked away from the festivities, perhaps tactfully. The Dean of Trinity showed him around Dublin and took him up to the north of Ireland, which was then, unlike today, politically a part of the same country. The Director of the Geological Survey of Ireland took him in hand and showed him around farms in the geologically fascinating parts of County Antrim. But though the tertiary basalts of the Giant's Causeway may well have enthralled him, his former reputation seems to have died hard in Ireland. Before long, according to local accounts, the newly created Dr. Smith was busily answering questions from the farmers about the efficiency of their drains. To add to the final honour, there was one final task. In 1834, the Palace of Westminster, where the British Houses of Parliament met, had been all but destroyed by fire. Sir Charles Barry had been commissioned, along with August Pugin, to conceive a fitting replacement, and duly did with his son Edward Barry, creating what went on to become what is possibly the most familiar and iconic of all London's great buildings, crowned as it is with the clock tower that holds the famous bell, Big Ben. In 1838, a four-man committee was established. Barry, Henry de la Beche, an architect named Charles Smith, and, with his brand-new honorific, Dr. William Smith. The committee was charged with the express purpose of selecting the stone that was to be used in the construction of the giant new edifice. The four men set out, by rail, such were these modern times, from Newcastle-upon-Tyne after that year's British Association meeting. They spent most of August and early September travelling by pony and trap, inspecting quarries, drawing up comparative tables of which stone was best for its workability, its appearance, its cost. The official report to the Commissioner of Her Majesty's Woods, Forests, Land Revenues, Works and Buildings was published in March the following year, 5 days before William Smith's 70th birthday. It listed more than 100 quarries. It compared the criteria of each, and it formally recommended that the new palace be built of a rock from a whitish-coloured upper Permian formation, a sandy magnesian limestone from a quarry at Mansfield Woodhouse in Derbyshire. It turned out to be a less than happy choice. The Mansfield quarry proved to have too little workable stone for the job, and another quarry at Bolsover had to be hastily substituted. Much the same happened there, with the stone running out within a matter of weeks. A third try at a nearby quarry in the village of Anston seemed to work, however. Before long, a train of barges was setting out regularly along the Chesterfield Canal to connect with the fast cargo sloops that sailed along the Trent and the Humber, and thence down past the Wash and the Norfolk coast to the Thames estuary and London. The quarry seemed bottomless. It provided in the end most of the stone for what were to be the visible upper parts of the palace for decades to come. Except that the Anston stone, which is technically a part of the Cadeby formation of the Zechstein epoch of the Upper Permian, proved a dismal selection. The committee had clearly not imagined the havoc that would be wrought on smooth sheets of a corrodible white-coloured limestone by the action of the winds and rains of newly industrialised London. A foul cocktail of acids, smoke, sulphur, heavy metals, and all manner of gases quite unknown in the pleasant towns of North Yorkshire, scoured the new buildings. The stone changed colour, flaked away, peeled off, broke. All of a sudden the grandest public building in the land had the look of a dour tenement in the middle of a slum. Within a decade of their completion, Barry's buildings were being roundly attacked for their appearance, for their ruined look, for their discoloration and decay. Charles Dickens led the fray. If the buildings of the day were going to be as ornate as Barry and Pugin seemed to want, he said, then let them be built of proper, durable stone. That chosen for the Houses of Parliament, Dickens fulminated in a newspaper article, is the worst ever used in the metropolis. And there were dark rumours about the Stone Selection Committee. Its members were accused obliquely of having merely junketed around the countryside during a pleasant summer at the taxpayers' expense, and not applying themselves properly to what was a profoundly serious business. It was Sir Henry de la Biche who took the brunt of public criticism. He had to testify before two select committees that were established specifically to make sure no public buildings ever suffered so embarrassing a fate again. No one seems to have blamed William Smith for anything. His involvement, said his admirers and detractors alike, was more of a sinecure for an honoured ancient. Few had expected he would perform any kind of actual task on the committee, useful or otherwise. In the years since Barry and Pugin built their masterpiece, the Palace of Westminster has suffered heroically from the capital's pollution, and further committees have recommended all manner of replacement stones in the hope that some might cheat the acid rainfall. These days the Commons building has been wholly rebuilt, using another limestone entirely, the warm, honey-coloured semi-eolitic limestone from the Middle Jurassic of Lincolnshire and known as Clipsham stone. Smith would have found the ironies delectable. First, that he managed to escape the opprobrium of the initial choice of a rock from the gloomy and fossil-free Permian, and second, that in the end it was his most favoured horizon, the Jurassic oolitic formation for which he and his great map are best known, that was used to face his country's best-known public building. Once again, the allure of the lively and warm shallow seas of Middle England's Middle Jurassic proved inescapable and irresistible. William Smith set out for Birmingham for the next British Association meeting the following August. He had spent the previous week in Oxfordshire, wandering through a number of great gardens, which John Phillips points out were spread across basement rocks of both the Jurassic and the Cretaceous. By this point Phillips seems to have become more than a little carried away by romantic notions about his elderly uncle's enduring interests, and has him placed here in summertime Oxfordshire, yet again pondering the great questions about Mesozoic stratification. One has to doubt it. More than likely, this stooped, deaf, rheumatic old man was taking time just to smell the roses and to keep out the possibility of a late summer chill. This he did not manage. His coach stopped in Northampton, and as he was in no great hurry, he decided to put up for a few days with an old friend named George Baker. He caught a cold, suspected nothing, and went to bed. but the cold settled on his lungs and it worsened. Doctors were called. John Phillips, already in Birmingham for the meeting, was summoned and arrived in Northampton on the morning of Tuesday, August the 27th. There was little he could do. Uncomplaining or unknowing, William Smith died shortly after 10 o'clock on the following night. He was buried nearby in St. Peter's Church. There are a number of memorials. The most poignant, with the longest and most erudite eulogy, stands in St. Peter's. It's a marble column, and it's topped, quite appropriately, with a copy of a bust by Matthew Noble. It was an appropriate choice indeed, since the sculptor was a man Smith had met and befriended in Hackness, the Yorkshire village where 8 years before his life had changed so much for the better, and public recognition of his astonishing talents got properly underway. Smith's own grave outside the church is topped by a massive block of sandstone, now so corroded that if there was any inscription, it is illegible. The original of Noble's bust of Smith stands in the museum at Oxford, near others of Buckland, Huxley, and Charles Darwin. There's another copy in the Geological Society, close to one of his nemesis, George Greenough. There is a tall monument standing beside the country bus shelter on the green in the little village of Churchill, where he was born, and a cul-de-sac of modern houses nearby has been named William Smith Close. There's a signpost pointing to Rugbourne Farm, which Smith himself thought of as the birthplace of the science he created. There's a plaque on Joseph Townsend's house in Bath, where the Table of Strata was dictated. There's another on the house at Tucking Mill, though as it happens, and typically for the memory of this often forgotten, often overlooked man, it is on the wrong house, and nobody has made any serious moves to try to shift it. And in the Geological Society there is a portrait. Beneath it, within the frame, there is a cut-out circle containing a lock of his hair, grey and curled, and apparently snipped off as he lay in George Baker's upstairs bedroom on the evening that he died. Overlooking this vaguely macabre memorial is a long marble staircase, and high up on the wall beside it a pair of pale blue curtains. Behind these curtains, if anyone can be found to pull the tasselled cord to part them, is the greatest of all memorials, the very map that William Smith created, all by himself in a labour of love that lasted for 15 years, or in truth, for all of his life. Normally, the map remains hidden from view, to keep it shielded from the light. The blue velvet curtains remain pulled firmly shut. The hundreds who pass by each day seldom glance up at it, and even if they do, few of them ever ask to see it, and fewer still ever stop to wonder who created it, and why, and exactly how.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to The Map That Changed the World, written and read by Simon Winchester. We thought you might also enjoy listening to another Harper audio, written and read by Simon Winchester, called The Professor and the Madman. It begins on CD9.
Harper Audio presents The Professor and the Madman, a tale of murder, insanity, and the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. Written and read by Simon Winchester. This book is dedicated to the memory of G.M. Preface. Mysterious. Adjective. Full of or fraught with mystery, wrapped in mystery, hidden from human knowledge or understanding, impossible or difficult to explain, solve or discover, of obscure origin, nature or purpose. Popular myth has it that one of the most remarkable conversations in modern literary history took place on a cool and misty late autumn afternoon in 1896, in the small village of Crowthorne in the county of Berkshire. One of the parties to the colloquy was the formidable Dr. James Murray, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. On the day in question, he had travelled 50 miles by train from Oxford to meet an enigmatic figure named Dr. W. C. Minor, who was among the most prolific of the thousands of volunteer contributors whose labours lay at the core of the dictionary's creation. For very nearly 20 years beforehand, these two men had corresponded regularly about the finer points of English lexicography, but they had never met. Dr. Minor seemed never willing or able to leave his home at Crowthorne, never willing to come to Oxford. He was unable to offer any kind of explanation, or to do more than offer his regrets. Dr. Murray, who himself was rarely free from the burdens of his work at the dictionary headquarters, the famous Scriptorium in Oxford, had nonetheless long dearly wished to see and thank his mysterious and intriguing helper, and particularly so by the late 1890s, with the dictionary well on its way to being half completed. Official honours were being showered upon all its creators, and Murray wanted to make sure that all those involved, even men so apparently bashful as Dr. Minor, were recognised for the valuable work they'd done. He decided he'd pay a visit. Once he had made up his mind to go, he telegraphed his intentions, adding that he'd find it most convenient to take a train that arrived at Crowthorne Station, then actually known as Wellington College Station, since it served the famous boys' school situated in the village, just after 2 on a certain Wednesday in November. Dr. Minor sent a wire by return to say that he was indeed expected and would be made most welcome. On the journey from Oxford, the weather was fine, the trains were on time, the auguries, in short, were good. At the railway station, a polished landau and a liveried coachman were waiting, and with James Murray aboard, they clip-clopped back through the lanes of rural Berkshire. After 20 minutes or so, the carriage turned up a long drive lined with tall poplars, drawing up eventually outside a huge and rather forbidding red-brick mansion. A solemn servant showed the lexicographer upstairs and into a book-lined study, where behind an immense mahogany desk stood a man of undoubted importance. Dr. Murray bowed gravely and launched into the brief speech of greeting that he had so long rehearsed. "A very good afternoon to you, sir. I'm Dr. James Murray of the London Philological Society and editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. It's indeed an honour and a pleasure to at long last make your acquaintance, for you must be, kind sir, my most assiduous helpmeet, Dr. W. C. Minor." There was a brief pause, a momentary air of mutual embarrassment. A clock ticked loudly. There were muffled footsteps in the hall, a distant clank of keys. And then the man behind the desk cleared his throat, and he spoke. "I regret, kind sir, that I am not. It's not at all as you suppose. I am, in fact, the governor of the Broadmoor Criminal Lunatic Asylum. Dr. Minor's most certainly here, but he is an inmate. He's been a patient here for more than 20 years. He's our longest-staying resident." Although the official government files relating to this case are secret and have been locked away for more than a century, I've recently been allowed to see them. What follows is the strange, tragic, and yet spiritually uplifting story that they reveal. The Dead of Night in Lambeth Marsh. Murder. Noun. The most heinous kind of criminal homicide, also an instance of this. In English, also Scottish and American law, defined as the unlawful killing of a human being with malicious aforethought, often more explicitly, willful murder. In Old English, the word could be applied to any homicide that was strongly reprobated. It had also the senses great wickedness, deadly injury, torment. More strictly, however, it denoted secret murder, which in Germanic antiquity was alone regarded as, in the modern sense, a crime, open homicide being considered a private wrong calling for blood revenge or compensation. Even under Edward I, Britain explains the ancient French meurtre only as felonious homicide of which both the perpetrator and the victim are unidentified. The malice aforethought, which enters into the legal definition of murder, does not, as now interpreted, admit of any summary definition. A person may even be guilty of willful murder without intending the death of the victim, as when death results from an unlawful act which the doer knew to be likely to cause the death of someone, or from injuries inflicted to facilitate the commission of certain offences. It is essential to murder that the perpetrator be of sound mind, and, in England, though not in Scotland, that death should ensue within a year and a day after the act presumed to have caused it. In British law, no degrees of guilt are recognised in murder. In the US, the law distinguishes murder in the first degree, where there are no mitigating circumstances, and murder in the second degree. In Victorian London, even in a place as louche and notoriously crime-ridden as Lambeth Marsh, the sound of gunshots was a rare event indeed. The Marsh was a sinister place, a jumble of slums and sin that crouched dark and ogre-like on the bank of the Thames just across from Westminster. Few respectable Londoners would ever admit to venturing there. It was a robustly violent part of town as well. The footpad lurked in Lambeth. There had once been an outbreak of garrotting, and in every crowded alley were the roughest kinds of pickpocket. Fagin, Bill Sykes and Oliver Twist would have all seemed quite at home in Victorian Lambeth. This was Dickensian London, writ large. But it was not a place for men with guns. The armed criminal was a phenomenon little known in the Lambeth of Prime Minister Gladstone's day, and even less known in the entire metropolitan vastness of London. Guns were costly, cumbersome, difficult to use, hard to conceal. Then, as still today, the use of a firearm in the commission of a crime was thought of as somehow a very un-British act, as something to be written about and recorded as a rarity. Happily, proclaimed a smug editorial in Lambeth's weekly newspaper, we in this country have no experience of the crime of shooting down, so common in the United States. So, when a brief fusillade of three revolver shots rang out shortly after 2 o'clock, on the moonlit Saturday morning of February the 17th, 1872, the sound was unimagined, unprecedented, and shocking. The three cracks, perhaps there were four, were loud, very loud, and they echoed through the cold and smokily damp night air. They were heard, and considering their rarity, just by chance instantly recognised, by a keen young police constable named Henry Tarrant, then attached to the Southwark Constabulary's L Division. The clocks had only recently struck two, his notes said later. He was performing with routine languor the duties of the graveyard shift, walking slowly beneath the viaduct arches beside Waterloo Railway Station, rattling the locks of the shops and cursing the bone-numbing chill. When he heard the shots, Tarrant blew his whistle to alert any colleagues who, he hoped, might be on patrol nearby, and he began to run. Within seconds he had raced through the warren of mean and slippery lanes that made up what in those days was still called a village, and he'd emerged into the wide riverside swath of Belvedere Road, from whence he was certain the sounds had come. Another policeman, Henry Burton, who had heard the piercing whistle, as had a third, William Ward, rushed to the scene. According to Burton's notes, he dashed towards the echoing sound and came across his colleague Tarrant, who was by then holding a man as if arresting him. "Quick!" cried Tarrant. "Go to the road. A man's been shot!" Burton and Ward raced towards Belvedere Road and within seconds found the unmoving body of a dying man. They fell to their knees, and onlookers noted that they had cast off their helmets and gloves and were hunched over the victim. There was blood gushing onto the pavement, blood staining a spot that would for many months afterward be described by London's more dramatically minded papers as the location of a heinous crime, a terrible event, an atrocious occurrence, a vile murder. The Lambeth tragedy, the papers eventually settled upon calling it, as if the simple existence of Lambeth itself were not something of a tragedy. Yet this was a most unusual event, even by the diminished standards of the marsh dwellers. For though the place where the killing occurred had over the years been witness to many strange events, the kind eagerly chronicled in the Penny Dreadfuls, this particular drama was to trigger a chain of consequences that was quite without precedent. And while some aspects of this crime and its aftermath would turn out to be sad and barely believable, not all of them, as this account will show, were to be wholly tragic. Far from it, indeed. Even today, Lambeth is a singularly unlovely part of the British capital, jammed anonymously between the great fan of roads and railway lines that take commuters in and out of the city centre from the southern counties. These days the Royal Festival Hall and the South Bank Centre stand there, built on the site of the 1951 fairgrounds, where an entertainment was staged to help cheer up the rationed and threadbare Londoners. Otherwise, it's an unlovely, characterless sort of place, rows of prison-like buildings that house the lesser government ministries, the headquarters of an oil company around which winter winds whip bitterly, a few unmemorable pubs and newspaper shops, and the lowering presence of Waterloo Station, lately expanded with the terminal for the Channel Tunnel express trains, which exerts its dull magnetic pull over the neighbourhood. The railway chiefs of old never bothered to build a grand station hotel at Waterloo, though they did build monster structures of great luxury at the other London stations like Victoria and Paddington, and even St Pancras and King's Cross. Lambeth has long been one of the nastier parts of London. Until very recently, with the further development of the Festival Hall site, no one of any style and consequence has ever wanted to linger there, neither a passenger back in the days of the Victorian boat trains, nor anyone for any reason at all today. It's slowly improving, but its reputation dogs it. 100 years ago, it was positively vile. It was still then low, marshy, and undrained, a swampy gyre of pathways where a sad little stream called the Neckinger seeped into the Thames. The land was jointly owned by the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Duke of Cornwall, landlords who, rich enough in their own right, never bothered to develop it in the manner of the great lords of London, Grosvenor, Bedford, and Devonshire, who created the squares, mansions, and terraces on the far side of the river. So it was instead a place of warehouses, tenant shacks, and miserable rows of ill-built houses. There were blacking factories, shoe polish makers like the one in which the young Charles Dickens worked, and there were soap boilers, small firms of dyers and lime burners, and tanning yards where the leather workers used a substance for darkening skins that was known as pure, and that was gathered from the streets each night by the filthiest of the local indigents, pure being a Victorian term for dog turds. A sickly smell of yeast and hops lay over the town, wafting from the chimneys of the great Red Lion Brewery, which stood on Belvedere Road just north of the Hungerford Bridge. And this bridge was symbolic of what encompassed the entire marsh, the railways, hefted high over the swamps on viaducts on which the trains, including those of the London Necropolis Railway, built to take corpses to the cemeteries in the suburb of Woking, chuffed and snorted, and across which miles of wagons lurched and banged. Lambeth was widely regarded as one of the noisiest and most sulphurous parts of a capital that had already a grim reputation for din and dirt. Lambeth Marsh was also, as it happened, just beyond the legal jurisdiction of both the cities of London and Westminster. It belonged administratively, at least until 1888, to the county of Surrey, meaning that the relatively strict laws that applied to the capital's citizens didn't apply to anyone who ventured, via one of the new bridges, like Waterloo or Blackfriars, Westminster or Hungerford, into the Wen of Lambeth. The village thus fast became known as a site of revelry and abandon, a place where public houses, brothels and lewd theatres abounded, and where a man could find entertainment of all kinds, and disease of all varieties, for no more than a handful of pennies. To see a play that wouldn't pass muster with the London censors, to be able to drink absinthe into the small hours of the morning, to buy the choicest pornography newly smuggled from Paris, or to have a girl of any age and not be concerned that a Bow Street runner, as London's early police were known, or her parents might chase after you, you went Surreyside, as they said, to Lambeth. But, as with most slums, its cheapness attracted respectable men to live and work in Lambeth too, and by all accounts, George Merritt was one of them. He was a stoker at the Red Lion Brewery. He'd been there for the previous 8 years, employed all the time as one of the gang who kept the fires burning through the day and the night, keeping the vats bubbling and the barley malting. He was 34 years old, and he lived locally at 24 Cornwall Cottages on the Cornwall Road. George Merritt was, like so many younger workers in Victorian London, an immigrant from the countryside, and so was his wife Eliza. He came from a village in Wiltshire, she from Gloucestershire. They'd both been farm labourers, and, with no protection by unions, no solidarity with their fellows, they'd been paid trifling sums to perform humiliating tasks for pitiless masters. They'd met at a farm show in the Cotswolds, and had vowed to leave together for the immeasurable possibilities offered by London only 2 hours away on the new express train from Swindon. They moved first to North London, where their first daughter, Claire, was born in 1860. Then they shifted into the city centre, and finally, in 1867, the family having become too large and costly and manual work too scarce, they found themselves near the brewery site in the bustling sty of Lambeth. The young couple's surroundings and lodgings were exactly as the illustrator Gustave Doré had drawn on one of his horrified expeditions from Paris, a dim world of bricks and soot and screeching iron, of huddled tenements, of tiny backyards, each with a privy and clothes boiler and washing line, and everywhere an air of damp and sulphurous stench, and even a rough-hewn, rollicking, hugger-mugger, devil-may-care, peculiarly London type of good cheer. Whether the Merritts missed the fields and the cider and the skylarks, or whether they imagined that that ideal had ever truly been the world they'd left, we'll never know. By the winter of 1871, George and Eliza had, as was typical of the inhabitants of the dingier quarters of Victorian London, a very substantial family. Six children, ranging from Claire at nearly 13 to Freddie at 12 months. Mrs. Merritt was about to be confined with her seventh pregnancy. They were a poor family, as were most in Lambeth. George Merritt brought home 24 shillings a week, a miserable sum even then. With rent payable to the Archbishop, and with food needed for the eight ever-opened mouths, theirs were straitened circumstances indeed. On the Saturday morning, just before 2 a.m, Merritt was awakened by a neighbour tapping on his window as prearranged. He rose from bed and readied himself for the dawn shift. It was a bitter morning, and he dressed as warmly as he could afford, a threadbare greatcoat over the kind of smock jacket that Victorians called a slop, a tattered grey shirt, corduroy trousers tied at the ankle with twine, heavy socks, and black boots. The clothes were none too clean, but he was to heave coal for the next 8 hours and couldn't be too bothered with appearance. His wife recalled him striking a light before leaving home. Her last sight of him was under one of the bright gas lamps with which Lambeth's streets had recently been equipped. His breath was visible in the cold night air, or maybe he was just puffing on his pipe, and he walked purposefully down to the end of Cornwall Road before turning into Belvedere Road. The night was clear and starlit, and once his footsteps had faded, soundless, except for the clanking and puffing of the ever-present railway engines. Mrs. Merritt had no reason to be concerned. She assumed, as she had for each of the 20 previous nights on which her husband had worked the dawn shift, that all would be well. George was simply making his way as usual towards the high walls and ornate gates of the great brewery where he worked, shovelling coal beneath the shadow of the great Red Lion that was one of London's better-known landmarks. There may have been little money in the job, but working at so famous an institution as the Red Lion Brewery, well, that was some reason for pride. But that night, George Merritt never reached his destination. As he passed the entrance to Tennyson Street between where the south side of the Lambeth Lead Works abutted onto the north wall of the brewery, there came a sudden cry. A man shouted at him, appeared to be chasing him, was yelling furiously. Merritt was frightened. This was something more than a mere footpad, that silent and menacing figure who lurked in the dark carrying a lead-tipped cosh and wearing a mask. This was something quite out of the ordinary, and Merritt began to run in terror, slipping and sliding on the frost-slick cobbles. He looked back. The man was still there, still chasing after him, still shouting angrily. Then, quite incredibly, he stopped and raised a gun, took aim, and fired. The shot missed, whistling past him and striking the brewery wall. George Merritt tried to run faster. He cried out for help. There was another shot, perhaps another, and then a final shot that struck the unfortunate Merritt in the neck. He fell heavily onto the cobbled pavement, his face down, a pool of blood spreading around him. Moments later came the running footfalls of Constable Burton, who found the man, lifted him, and attempted to comfort him. The other policeman, William Ward, summoned a passing hansom cab from the still-busy thoroughfare of Waterloo Road. They gently picked the wounded man up from the ground, hoisted him onto the vehicle, and ordered the driver to take them as fast as possible to St. Thomas's Hospital, 500 yards further south on Belvedere Road, across from the Archbishop's London Palace. The horses did their best, their hooves striking sparks from the cobbles as they rushed the victim to the emergency entrance. It was a futile journey. Doctors examined George Merritt and attempted to close the gaping wound in his neck. But his carotid artery had been severed, his spine snapped by 2 large-caliber bullets. The man who had perpetrated this unprecedented crime was, within moments of committing it, in the firm custody of Constable Tarrant. He was a tall, well-dressed man of what the policeman described as military appearance, with an erect bearing and a haughty air. He held a still-smoking revolver in his right hand. He made no attempt to run, but stood silently as the policeman approached. "Who is it that's fired?" asked the constable. "I did," said the man, holding up the gun. Tarrant snatched it from him. "Whom did you fire at?" he asked. The man pointed down Belvedere Road to the figure lying motionless beneath a street lamp just outside the brewery's store. He made the only droll remark that history records him as having made, but a remark that, as it happens, betrayed one of the driving weaknesses of his life. "It was a man," he said, with a tone of disdain. "You do not suppose I'd be so cowardly as to shoot at a woman?" By now two other policemen had arrived on the scene as had inquisitive locals, among them the Hungerford Bridge toll collector, who at first hadn't dared go out for fear I'd take a bullet, and a woman undressing in her room on Tennyson Street, a street in which it was apparently far from uncommon for women to be undressing at all hours. Constable Tarrant, pointing towards the victim and ordering his two colleagues to see what they could do for him and to prevent a crowd from gathering, escorted the supposed and unprotesting murderer to the Tower Street police station. On the way, his prisoner became rather more voluble, though Tarrant described him as cool, collected, and clearly not affected by drink. It had all been a terrible accident. He'd shot the wrong man, he insisted. He was after someone else, someone quite different. Someone had broken into his room. He was simply chasing him away, defending himself as anyone surely had a perfect right to do. "Don't handle me," he said, when Tarrant put a hand on his shoulder. But then, rather more gently, he said to the policeman, "You haven't searched me, you know." "I'll do that at the station," replied the constable. "How do you know I haven't got another gun, and might shoot you?" The policeman, plodding and imperturbable, replied that if he did have another gun, perhaps he'd be so kind as to keep it in his pocket for the time being. "But I do have a knife," replied the prisoner. "Keep that in your pocket also," said the stolid constable. There turned out to be no other gun, but a search did turn up a long hunting knife in a leather sheath strapped to the man's belt behind his back. "A surgical instrument," it was explained. "I don't always carry it with me." Tarrant, once he had completed the search, explained to the desk sergeant what had happened on Belvedere Road a few moments before. The pair then set about formally interviewing the arrested man. His name was William Chester Minor. He was 37 years old, and as the policeman suspected from his bearing, a former army officer. He was also a qualified surgeon. He'd lived in London for less than a year, and had taken rooms locally, living alone in a simple, furnished upstairs room nearby at 41 Tennyson Street. He evidently had no financial need to live so economically, for he was in fact a man of very considerable means. He hinted that he had come to this lubricious quarter of town for reasons other than the simply monetary, though what those reasons might be didn't emerge in the early interrogations. By dawn he was taken off to the Horsemonger Lane jail, charged with murder. But there was one additional complication. William Minor, it turned out, came from New Haven, Connecticut. He had a commission in the U.S. Army. He was an American. This put a wholly new complexion on the case. The American legation now had to be told. And so, in mid-morning, despite its being a Saturday, the Foreign Office formally notified the U.S. Minister in London that one of their army surgeons had been arrested and was being held on a charge of murder. The shooting on Belvedere Road, Lambeth, already because of its rarity a cause celebre, had now become an international incident. The British papers, always eager to vent editorial spleen on their transatlantic rivals, made hay with this particular aspect of the story. "The light estimation in which human life is held by Americans," sniffed the South London press, "may be noted as one of the most significant points of difference between them and Englishmen, and this is a most shocking example of it brought to our own doors. The victim of a cruel mistake has left a wife near confinement and seven children, the eldest only 13, to the mercy of the world. It's gratifying to be able to record that the benevolent are coming forward with alacrity to the succour of the widow and the fatherless, and it's most sincerely to be hoped that all who can spare even a trifle will do their best to help the victims of this dreadful tragedy. The American Vice Consul General has, in the most thoughtful manner, opened a subscription list and issued an appeal to Americans now in London to do what they can to alleviate the misery which an act of their countrymen's has entailed. Scotland Yard detectives were soon put onto the case, so important had it suddenly become that justice was seen to be done on both sides of the Atlantic. Since Minor, silent in his prison cell, was offering no help, except to say that he didn't know the victim and had shot him in error, they began to investigate any possible motive. In doing so, they uncovered the beginnings of the trail of a remarkable and tragic life. William Minor had come to Britain the previous autumn because he was ill, suffering at least in part from an ailment some papers said was occasioned by the looseness of his private life. It was suggested by the lawyer later appointed to defend him that his motivation in coming to England was to quiet a mind that had become, as Victorian doctors were apt to say, inflamed. It was said that he had suffered a lesion on the brain, and many causes were put forward for it. He had, according to his lawyer, been in an asylum in the United States, and he had taken retirement from the army on the grounds of ill health. He'd been described by those who met him as a gentleman of fine education and ability, but with eccentric and dissolute habits. He first settled at Radley's Hotel in the West End, and from there travelled by train to the major cities of Europe. He'd brought with him a letter from a friend at Yale University, recommending him to John Ruskin, the celebrated British artist and critic. The two men had met once, and Minor had been encouraged to take his watercolours along with him on his travels, and to paint as a form of relaxation. As the police imagined, Minor had moved from the West End shortly after Christmas 1871 and settled in Lambeth, a highly dubious choice for a man of his background and breeding, unless, as he later admitted, it offered him easy access to easy women. The American authorities told Scotland Yard that they already had records of his behaviour as an army officer. He had a long history of frequenting what were then beginning to be called the Tenderloin districts of the cities in which he'd been posted, most notably New York, where he'd been assigned to Governor's Island, and from where, on his leave days, he had regularly gone to some of Manhattan's roughest bars and music halls. He had, it was said, a prodigious sexual appetite. He had caught venereal diseases at least once, and a medical examination conducted at Horsemonger Lane Jail showed that he had a case of gonorrhea even then. He'd caught it, he said, from a local prostitute, and he'd tried to cure it by injecting white Rhine wine into his urethra, an almost amusingly inventive attempt at a remedy, and one that, not surprisingly, failed. His room, however, betrayed none of this seamier side. The detectives reported that they'd found his heavy, leather and brass-bound portmanteaus, a great deal of money, mainly French in 20-livre notes, a gold watch and chain, some Ely's bullets for his gun, his surgeon's commission, and his letter of appointment as a captain in the U.S. Army. There was also the letter of introduction to Ruskin, as well as a large number of watercolours, evidently by Minor himself. They were said by everyone who saw them to be of the highest quality, views of London largely, many from the hills above the Crystal Palace. His landlady, Mrs. Fisher, said that he had been a perfectly good tenant, but odd. He used to go away for several days at a time, and on returning rather ostentatiously left his hotel bills, the Charing Cross Hotel was one she remembered, the Crystal Palace Hotel another, lying around for all to see. He seemed, she said, a very anxious man. Often he demanded that the furniture in his room be moved. He also seemed afraid that people might break in. He had one particular worry, Mrs. Fisher told the police. Dr. Minor was apparently formidably afraid of the Irish. He'd ask interminably whether or not she had any Irish servants working in the house, and if so, demand they be sacked. Did she have Irish visitors, any Irish lodgers? He was always to be kept informed of a possibility that in Lambeth, which had a large population of casual Irish labourers working on the legions of London construction sites, was in fact all too real. Yet it wasn't until the murder trial, held in early April, that the full extent of Dr. Minor's illness became starkly apparent. Among the scores of witnesses who appeared before the Lord Chief Justice in the court at Kingston Assizes, for this was Surrey's jurisdiction still, not London's, three of them told a stunned courtroom what they knew of the sad captain. The London police, for a start, admitted that they were already somewhat acquainted with him and that for some time before the murder had known that they had a troubled man living in their midst. A Scotland Yard detective named Williamson testified that Minor had come to the yard 3 months earlier, complaining that men were coming to his rooms at night trying to poison him. He thought that they were members of the Fenian Brotherhood, militant Irish nationalists, and that they were bent on breaking into his lodgings, hiding in the roof rafters, slipping through the windows. He made such allegations several times, said Williamson. Shortly before Christmas, Minor had even persuaded the Commissioner of Police in New Haven to write a letter to the Yard, underlining the fears that Minor felt. Even after the doctor moved to Tennyson Street, he kept in touch with Williamson. On January the 12th, 1872, he wrote that he had been drugged and was afraid that the Fenians were planning to murder him and make it look as though his death had been a suicide. A classic cry for help, one might think today, but an exasperated Superintendent Williamson did nothing and told no one, beyond noting with some contempt in his logbook that Minor was clearly, and this was the first use of the word to describe the hapless American, insane. Then came a witness who had something very curious to offer from his observations of Dr. Minor during the time the American was held on remand in the cells at Horsemonger Lane. The witness, whose name was William Dennis, was a member of a profession that has long since receded from modern memory. He was what was called a Bethlehem watcher. Usually he was employed at London's Bethlehem Hospital for the Insane, such a dreadful place that the name has given us the word bedlam, where his duties included watching the prisoner patients through the night to make sure that they behaved themselves and didn't try to cheat justice by committing suicide. He'd been seconded to the Horsemonger Lane jail in mid-February, he said, to watch the nocturnal activities of the strange visitor. He had watched him, he testified, for 24 nights. It was a most curious and disturbing experience, Dennis told the jury. Each morning, Dr. Minor would awake and immediately accuse him of having been paid by someone specifically to molest him while he slept. Then he'd spit dozens of times as though trying to remove something that had been put into his mouth. He'd next leap from his bed and scrabble about underneath it, looking for people who, he insisted, had hidden there and were planning to annoy him. Dennis told his superior, the prison surgeon, that he was quite certain William Minor was mad. From the police interrogation notes came the evidence of an imagined motive for the crime, and with them a further indication of Dr. Minor's patent instability. Each night, Minor had told his questioners, unknown men, often lower class, often Irish, would come to his room while he was sleeping. They would maltreat him, they'd violate him in ways he couldn't possibly describe. For months, ever since these nocturnal visitors had begun to torment him, he had taken to sleeping with his Colt service revolver, loaded with 5 cartridges, beneath his pillow. On the night in question, he awoke with a start, certain that a man was standing in the shadows at the foot of his bed. He reached under the pillow for his gun. The man saw him and took to his heels, running down the stairs and out of the house. Minor followed him as fast as he could, saw a man running down into Belvedere Road, was certain that this was the intruder, shouted at him, then fired 4 times until he had hit him, and the man lay still, unable to harm him further. The court listened in silence. The landlady shook her head. No one could get into her house at night without a key, she had said. Everyone slept very lightly. There could not have been an intruder. And as a final confirmation, the court then heard from the prisoner's stepbrother, George Minor. It had been a nightmare, said George, having brother William staying in the family house in New Haven. Every morning he'd accused people of trying to break into his room, the night before trying to molest him. He was being persecuted. Evil men were trying to insert metallic biscuits coated with poison into his mouth. They were in league with others who hid in the attic, came down at night while he was asleep, and treated him foully. Everything was punishment, he said, for an act he had been forced to commit while in the American army. Only by going to Europe, he said, could he escape his demons. He'd travel and paint and live the life of a respected gentleman of art and culture, and the persecutors might melt away into the night. The court listened in melancholy silence while Dr. Minor sat in the dock, morose, shamed. The lawyer, the American consul general, had procured for him, said only that it was clear that his client was insane, and that the jury should treat him as such. The chief justice nodded his agreement. It had been a brief but sorry case, the defendant an educated and cultured man, a foreigner and a patriot, a figure quite unlike the wretches who more customarily stood in the dock before him. But the law had to be applied with just precision, whatever the condition or estate of the defendant, and the decision in this affair was in a sense a foregone conclusion. For 30 years the law in such cases had been guided by what were known as the McNaughton Rules, named for the man who in 1843 shot dead Sir Robert Peel's secretary, and who was acquitted on the grounds that he was so mad he couldn't tell right from wrong. The rules, which judged criminal responsibility rather than guilt, were to be applied in this case, he told the jury. If they were convinced that the prisoner was of unsound mind, and had killed George Merritt while under some delusion of the kind that they had just heard about, then they must do as juries were wont to do in this extraordinarily lenient time in British justice. They were to find William Chester Minor not guilty on grounds of insanity, and leave the judge to apply such custodial sanction as he felt prudent and necessary. And that is what the jury did, without deliberation, late on the afternoon of April the 6th, 1872. They found Dr. Minor legally innocent of a murder that all, including him, knew that he had committed. The Lord Chief Justice then applied the only sentence that was available to him, a sentence still passed occasionally today, and that has a beguiling charm to its language, despite the swinging awfulness of its connotations. "You will be detained in safe custody, Dr. Minor," said the judge, "until Her Majesty's pleasure be known." It was a decision that was to have unimaginable and wholly unanticipated implications, effects that echo and ripple through the English literary world to this day. The Home Department took brief note of the sentence, and made the further decision that Dr. Minor's detention, which, considering the severity of his illness, was likely to occupy the rest of his natural life, would have to be suffered in the newly built showpiece of the British penal system, a sprawling set of red brick buildings located behind high walls and spiked fences in the village of Crowthorne in the Royal County of Berkshire. Dr. Minor was to be transported as soon as was convenient from his temporary prison in Surrey to the Asylum for the Criminally Insane, Broadmoor. Dr. William C. Minor, Surgeon Captain, U.S. Army, a forlornly proud figure from one of the oldest and best-regarded families of New England, was henceforward to be formally designated in Britain by Broadmoor File Number 742, and to be held in permanent custody as a certified criminal lunatic.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.